All right, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Towards the back end of the show, we have a very special treat. All right? There's a brand new audio clip from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's all about this election madness. And the title of that clip is, Let's Be Real Here. As bad as Bush was, in many ways, Obama is worse. So stay tuned for that. I know you're going to want to hear that. You're going to want to listen to that. You want to jump up and argue about it, talk about it, all this stuff. So keep your ears glued to this station and to this show for the next hour. All right? Before that, we'll be talking with Jamel Mims. Jamel is one of the defendants in the stop and frisk trial currently going on in New York City, and we'll be talking about that case, the significance of it, and what's at stake. But opening the show up, I'm really happy to be talking about something that has been bugging the hell out of me for the last number of weeks, ever since I first heard about this. The federal authorities in the Northwest have launched a wave of repression against activists in Portland, raiding houses to seize anarchist and anti-government literature, taking artwork and computers, and calling a number of people before a federal grand jury in Seattle, which has resulted in three of the activists being jailed without trial for refusing to participate in the clampdown and name names. Joining us now to talk about this is Neil Fox, president of the Seattle chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Neil, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good, very good. Very good and very angry. So that's very good, too. There you go. You know, I should ask you how you're doing in relation to all this. And tell us, give us a sense of just what the hell is going on up there, man.
Well, I should begin by saying that I don't represent any of the people that are currently in jail. And I'm not personally representing any of the witnesses in this case. I'm the president of the Seattle chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. And we're very concerned that these grand jury subpoenas are being used to harass and intimidate political activists in the Northwest. They're being used basically to chill the free exercise of First Amendment rights. We've seen in some of the materials that have been made public that the FBI was searching for anti-government literature in some of the houses that they searched. Anytime the government uses Joint Terrorism Task Force to burst into people's houses and seize anti-government literature, we have to step back and say, what is going on here? And so I'll ask the same rhetorical question that you asked.
Actually, mine wasn't all that rhetorical. I'm really incensed about what's happening there. And give people a sense of this, because from what I read about this, I mean, there were things like, you know, these early morning raids, you know, having people standing out in their yard in the cold in their underwear and just sweeping through and taking all kinds of things from these houses.
Right.
Give people
computers,
a sense of what these raids
were. Cell phones, anti-government literature, clothing. And supposedly, you know, this is all under the guise of trying to find out who caused damage to federal property during the May Day demonstrations this past May. As it turns out, last week there were reports in the mainstream media basically what happened is that one of the search warrant affidavits was accidentally unsealed when it was filed with the court. And the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and Seattle Times got copies of these search warrant affidavits, which I have not seen. But according to the mainstream media reports, the FBI actually was following people coming up from Oregon and basically spying on them before the May Day demonstrations. So this what took place in Seattle, the property destruction at the federal courthouse on May Day, I see as being used as kind of a jurisdictional hook by which the federal government can find out about people's associational activities and who's reading what and what type of literature people are reading, who they're associating with. If in fact, and according to this, you know, the mainstream media reports, the FBI was following people before they followed them up from Portland before they arrived in Seattle, then this investigation really has little to do really with finding out who caused property damage on May 1st.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, actually, one of the defendants in the grand jury situation, Leah Lynn Plant, is it Plante or Plant?
I'm not sure how she pronounces
yeah.
her name. And she's not really a defendant. She's a witness. None of these people have been charged with crimes. None of them are necessarily the targets of the grand jury. They're being called in as witnesses to testify about what they know about what other people may have done, or we don't really know, because one of the problems with the grand jury system is that it's secret. It's cloaked in secrecy. This is a feudal institution that goes back 1,000 years, and it has very strange procedural parts to it. I mean, it's cloaked in secrecy. when people are called in front of federal grand juries, their lawyers aren't even allowed in the room with them. Their lawyers have to sit in the hallway outside. And so someone, you know, a young person, you know, maybe 20, 25 years old, who, you know, is freaked out about being called in front of a grand jury, they're brought into the grand jury room, and if they have a question about, you know, what their testimony would be, they would have to go outside and talk to their lawyer outside the grand jury room. And so you have this kind of cloak of secrecy over the whole proceedings. The rules are set up so that the prosecutors are precluded from even talking about what goes on in the grand jury room. So no one really knows what's going on. You know, you have witnesses that are called in front of the grand jury who, if they refuse to answer questions, they're given immunity by the prosecutors. And they're told, you have to testify because we won't charge you for anything you say inside the grand jury room. You're immune for prosecution for anything you might say. We can still prosecute you later based upon other evidence, but as for your very words, we are not going to prosecute you. So therefore, you don't have a Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. You have to testify, and if you don't testify, we're going to fine you in contempt. And then we're going to put you in jail as a sanction for contempt until the grand jury stops investigating, and that could be 18 months down the road.
You know, one of the things, well, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Neil Fox, who's the president of the Seattle branch of the National Lawyers Guild. And actually, as I understand it, Neil, the Lawyers Guild is actually helping to hook some of the people who are being called before grand juries and whatnot up with lawyers who will represent them, right?
Right. That's correct. And some of our members are the actual lawyers for the individuals. But the Lawyers Guild chapter itself doesn't represent anyone mm-hmm. who's called in front of the grand jury.
Right.
But we are very concerned about this whole process.
Right, exactly. And one of the things, just coming off of your last comments, you know, the one of the things I've always heard about the grand jury is that it's sort of, and you know, there's been these situations where there's runaway grand juries, and I think that's something that always is hovering there. But there's actually a, you know, in terms of most of them are not runaway. Most of them are very carefully directed. And I understand that the Vatican's Grand Inquisitor might have a role in running some of this. But but it's also that there's a thing of this grand jury has absolute power in terms of what it wants to investigate and who it wants to investigate. And it's not bound by any kind of parameters in terms of what kinds of questions it can ask or probe, right?
Right. Well, it's wrong to say that the grand jury is completely running amok in the sense that there's no one directing it. The U.S. Attorney's Office is charged basically with directing the grand jury. So the Department of Justice, the federal government, they decide what to present to the grand jury. They decide what witnesses to present to the grand jury, and they use the grand jury as an investigative tool. So ordinarily, the federal government doesn't have a right to know what, who associates with who, on political grounds, who's reading what literature, who may attend anarchist gatherings, who may be talking, you know, about revolution. I mean, it's not really the federal government's business to know that. But through the use of a grand jury, the federal government can find that information out by calling people, giving them immunity orders, and coercing them to answer questions about such things. So it's not that the grand jury is this completely independent body that's just kind of picking and choosing arbitrarily what to do. There's someone directing that grand jury. You know, and the irony in all of this is that historically the grand jury was supposed to be a protection for people. It's written into the text of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution that you can't prosecute people for serious crimes in the federal system without a grand jury indictment. It's supposed to be a protection for people. It's supposed to stand between a prosecutor, or in the old days, the crown, and individual people and give them that layer of protection. That's not the way the system currently works. It's not a protection for people. It's actually a tool for the government to extract information that they're not necessarily entitled to.
Exactly. And that's actually the point I was trying to get at before is exactly this thing is it's being very carefully directed from the, from the Justice Department and at that level. But it can go in terms of this last thing you said, in terms of it supposedly going from being, you know, protective, supposedly, to actually being able to do and go where they want. And the kinds of questions they've been asking, and I was looking at this, and again, clearly directed, But I was looking at Leah Lynn Plante's comment, and when she talked about the Orwellian character of all of this in terms of even what they were going after and the things that you had mentioned about seizing anti-government literature and all this stuff that were in people's houses, computers, cell phones, checking text messages, all of these kinds of things. And in Leah Lynn's case, she wasn't even in. It's not even that she was being watched beforehand. She wasn't even in Seattle on the day on May Day.
Right. And by the way, I believe that she's been released from the Federal Detention Center.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen reports of that. So mm-hmm. I don't know that Leah is currently being held.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. And, you know, the government will say, well, you know, like in any other criminal case, this is going to be the government's justification. There may be information that people have that aren't present at the scene of the, quote, crime. Right. So, you know, if they're investigating a drug case and there's a drug transaction that takes place in California, the government may say, well, we have the right to investigate people who are in Washington who may have information about how that crime went down. So that's going to be the government's justification, mm-hmm. that, well, here you have a crime. We're trying to figure out who committed this crime. This person may have information. So therefore, we get to compel her testimony. You know, I should, you know, we should step back and look over the, you know, the last generation, how grand juries have been used in other situations to chill freedom of speech. I don't know if people remember, there was a New York Times reporter, Judith Miller, who was incarcerated for a couple of months, I believe, when she refused to turn over to a grand jury information about her sources in the Valerie Plame incident, where, you know, someone in the Bush administration leaked information about the identity of a CIA agent. And Judith Miller, who is a, you know, New York Times reporter, was incarcerated for a couple of months, I believe, because she refused to give information that she thought was protected by the First Amendment, you know, under some sort of journalist privilege. And the courts actually rejected that. So you have, you know, this history of the grand jury that has the potential for chilling the exercise of First Amendment activity. Someone may not want to, a young person, for instance, who's, you know, sees that there's great injustice in our economic system, is you know, trying to figure it out, may not want to go to a demonstration, may not want to go to an anarchist bookstore, may not want to associate with people that have strong political views, because that person may not want to get dragged in front of a grand jury and be questioned about his or her beliefs. And in that way, this has a chilling effect. That's what I mean by a chilling effect, that it discourages people from exercising their First Amendment rights because they don't want to have the risk of being locked up in a jail or having to name names about who they associate with.
Mm-hmm. Very important point. And let me remind listeners that we're talking with Neil Fox, and he's the president of the Seattle branch of the National Lawyers Guild. And we're talking about the grand juries that are currently operating up in the Pacific Northwest. Now, Neil, you know, just in that we're running up on our time, but I wanted to have people understand, and maybe you can help us understand, exactly what is the extent of this now? How many houses have been raided? Have any people been actually arrested and charged? And how many people have been dragged up before grand juries? And what has happened when they have been dragged up?
Well, okay, we know of three people who have been found in contempt for refusing to testify. Two of them are currently in jail. Leah Plant was released. I don't know how many other people have received grand jury subpoenas. And part of the problem is that all of this is secret. And so we really have no idea what the full extent of the investigation is. There may be people that are, you know, who get the subpoenas and do go to testify before the grand jury. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know of a couple of houses in Portland that were raided back in late July. There was a house in Seattle that was raided by the Seattle police in early July or late June, and it's not clear if that's tied into this investigation. I'm sorry, the other part of your question was?
Well, I'm just trying to, you know, how many people have been charged? Have any people been charged?
Well, there's been one person who was charged with destroying the windows of the federal courthouse. He was arrested very quickly after the incident. My understanding is that he pled guilty and received credit for time served. So the irony is that people are being held for contempt for a longer period of time for refusing to answer questions to the grand jury than the person who actually, one of the people that actually destroyed the windows of the federal courthouse.
So, that
one person was charged.
Now, let me ask you this. In their search for, you know, connections and networks, which I understand has been the main focus of the questioning, that some, when people have talked about what they've been questioned about, they said that there's been a real search for who do you know, who do you hang out with, who's part of your network, who knows who. Has there been any sort of expanding out in those circles, like somebody, you know, that, and I'm just curious, as have they actually gone out and searched down themselves the various connections from the things that they seized from people's houses? Have they expanded this?
I don't know.
Okay.
And some of that I'm just not privy to because it's secret.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me tell you this. One of the things that got me very, 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 really angry was, you know, nobody from the government has said much of anything. And then
they
can't
because they're bound by, quote, secrecy.
Right. But then they had this woman, Emily Langley, and she was commenting on the jailing of people who refused to answer grand jury questions. And she said, it's not punitive, it's coercive.
Right.
And I kept thinking, okay, there's yet again another Orwellian, you know, gem,
right.
You know?
Right. And, you know, Emily Langley used to be a news reporter who now is the media spokesperson for the U.S. Attorney's Office. And in terms of contempt, you know, historically there's criminal contempt where people are tried for contempt as a separate crime, and then they receive a prison sentence or a jail sentence as punishment. There's something called civil contempt, which historically is not a criminal type of proceeding. It's designed to get someone to change their behavior, and that's called being coercive. So we'll jail you, but the judges always say this. It's kind of an odd saying, but you hold the keys to the jail door
because you
can always cooperate with what we're asking you to do, and then you just walk out.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was
So they use the term coercive in the sense that we're just going to lock you up, and when you decide you've had enough, then you come in and talk, and then you walk out.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in South Africa, they used to talk about shoving pieces of tin up under people's fingernails, a lot of the anti-apartheid activists, and they also said, you hold the keys, we'll stop this if you just tell us. So that was coercive and not punitive, too.
Well, you know, as just an aside, last year I taught for 2 weeks in Minsk in Belarus, and right before I arrived, there was an anti-government demonstration in the main square, windows were broken, and the KGB, and they still have the KGB there, used this as an excuse to raid anti-government activist houses, call people in to the KGB, and through cell phone triangulation, they knew which phones had been used in the area of the window breaking, and they called people into the KGB to say, hey, we noticed that you were making phone calls in the area of this demonstration. Do you know anything about what took place? And it seems really similar.
Yeah, right. Neil, on that note, we have to wrap this up because we're running on a tight schedule here. But
thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for joining us, man, and we'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
All right, bye.
Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Neil Fox, president of the Seattle chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, about the grand jury's raids, government spying, and all that's been happening up in the Pacific Northwest. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Jamel Mims, one of the defendants in the Stop and Frisk trial currently going on in New York City. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. I can't stand it. I can't stand it anymore. More. That's what's happening around here. I can't stand it. And joining us now to talk about something else that nobody should stand is Stop and Frisk and the fact that there are a number of anti-Stop and Frisk activists in New York City who are currently facing, some of them are on trial, some of them are still facing charges, some of the ones that are on trial are facing other charges and face new trials coming up. There is a massive assault going on in the courtrooms against the people, the freedom fighters fighting to stop and frisk. And joining us to talk about this is one of those freedom fighters, Jamel Mims. Jamel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Sure. All right, man, I can't stand it, so you got to get me on fire again here, all right? Why don't you tell people, you're facing trial right now. Why don't you tell people what is going on there? What happened? What's it about? What's going on?
Okay, so right now we're on trial facing charges, you know, two charges of obstruction of government administration carrying 1 year each, and a disorderly conduct charge for a nonviolent civil disobedience protest in Queens at the 103rd Precinct, which is a precinct that's notorious for housing the murderers of Sean Bell. Now, you know, let me just back up a second and say, what we're looking at a time now where this policy has reached, you know, controversy and it's fomenting divisions, even at, amongst the top and even amongst the architects of this program. You have guys like Mayor Bloomberg and Ray Kelly, who have dug their heels in. You see them going around the churches in Brooklyn, like the Christian Cultural Center, and delivering speeches, essentially justifying their use of the practice. And you see, you know, politicians lining up on the left and right to either reform or scale back this policy. And now, you know, a year ago, when no one knew what Stop and Frisk was, and even those who were targeted by it themselves felt that there was nothing they can do about it, now a year later, you have an environment that is combative around the issue and that is presenting serious problems for the people who are, you know, for the people who are at the top of this, you know, of this food chain. So in this context, what we see is the scaling up of our charges, the doubling down on it, the digging their heels in to prosecute us and to make us actually serve jail time for bringing an issue into the limelight, which everyone right now, you know, and people are increasingly more and more in a very viral fashion starting to see is rooted in an absolute human rights nightmare. So this isn't at all divorced from, you know, the attacks on whistleblowers and people who have been bringing issues into the spotlight. Not at all.
Well, there's something very, very heavy in this, though. That's not that there isn't in these other things, but there's something very, very heavy in terms of you're talking about an action on the part of the authorities, on the part of a system that is actually, you know, that is linked very much to a whole genocidal assault on a section of people, especially Black and Latino youth. And this is something that, whether it's the pipeline to prison, all this stuff, people talk about the schools being a pipeline to prison. That's true. At the same time, the stop and frisk is very much that kind of situation. And it's really, that's part of the thing I think that lends such great weight and moral weight to what you folks have been doing in terms of standing up and fighting this and to the need for people to step up and defend you and come to the support of you and of the stop and frisk movement in the course of this trial.
Right. I mean, this is a fight that is not at all divorced from that. This is a fight that is fully bound up with the hopes and of those thousands of people, actually millions of people who have had their lives completely violated by this policy and the system of mass incarceration as a whole, for those thousands of people who felt that there was nothing you can do about this. Our fate and what happens to us and what is, in fact, allowed to happen to us and what is tolerated to happen to us, as people who put their bodies on the line to actually spotlight and highlight this policy, is completely bound up with it. It isn't individually contingent on, right? We shouldn't reduce this to, but it is completely bound up within the hopes and, you know, the hopes of those thousands of people for actually raising their heads and resisting this policy and getting up out of all of that. This should function like a wedge, you know, a kind of wedge issue where stop and frisk opens the door into, just as you were saying, a school to, you know, we were talking about a school to prison pipeline. We're talking about Stop It First, because a pipeline program to the system of mass incarceration, which has 2.4 million people behind bars, 8 million under community supervision. What you're looking at is a program that's moving in a decidedly genocidal direction that could very quickly become a fast, you know, a very quick, you know, it could very quickly hasten its pace.
Mm-hmm.
The issue that we're dealing with.
Right. A very quick question, factually. I want people, you guys are facing 2 years in jail now. And it's very heavy because the prosecutors and the court system is actually arguing, and the police, they're arguing that there's nothing involved here except the facts of the crime. And there's a whole way that you've approached this. First, I'd like you to tell people what actually, you know, you talked about piling up charges. What are they doing? And what kind of charges are being piled on you? And then I'll continue the question there because there's a second part to it.
Yeah. So the charges are, you know, two counts of obstructing government administration that are actually based on two different kind of theories of prosecuting the obstruction charge. So they both stem from a single act, the maximum penalty of it is, in terms of time, would be 1 year. But this isn't a one-year charge. It's two individual 2-year charges, and they took one OGA, and when we were first charged, there was one OGA. They added a second OGA stemming from the same act. And then the kind of third thing is right at the 11th hour of trial, we were actually supposed to go on trial on October 9th. Right on the eve of trial, the prosecutor enters in a phrase, acting in concert, which implies nothing less than associative liability. So this changes our, so that has to change our entire theory of defense. We moved from being charged as principals, as in each of us acting individually, to being charged as acting in association or in concert. So this is the way that they were trying to stack this up and really kind of stack these charges up to actually, as punishment. And again, we see this in the context of this is the third citywide action against the stop and frisk policy that engendered massive resistance against the policy on a scale, and what we've seen in the past 12 months that's been, a change in the political terrain as a result of those civil disobedience protests, which showed people there was something that you could do about it, that actually people were doing something about it.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Jamel Mims, who's a multimedia artist, hip-hop pedagogue, and activist, and he's one of the people on trial in New York City, one of four defendants on trial in New York City around the Stop and Frisk movement and a police assault on that Stop, Stop, and Frisk movement, and they're being charged with very heavy charges that actually could end up with 2 years in jail, and that's presenting a moral imperative to everyone who's listening to this show and everyone who knows about this. This cannot be tolerated. You got to stand up and say, I can't stand this. Now, Jamel, tell me something here. You've commented, you guys as a group have commented, and I should also let people know Carl Dix is also one of the defendants in this, and he's been on the show a number of times. He's a frequent guest and somebody that our listeners actually really look forward to hearing from. And we've talked a lot about this and about the Stop, Stop, and Frisk movement. But one of the things that you guys have done in relation to this courtroom process is the government keeps insisting that it's a case that's not, involves nothing else other than a violation of these particular laws. It has nothing to do with rights. It has nothing to do with right to protest or anything else. You guys are saying, we're going to fight this out. You're saying, bull, we're going to fight this out in the courtroom as a political trial. We're going to take this case. We're going to take Stop and Frisk into the courtroom. What do you mean? How are you doing? And how's it going?
Right. I mean, this is, again, they kind of throw the blinds on have the jury focus in and fit everything into their very twisted context of the law. I mean, they put in this thing, this is not about Stop and Frisk, this is not about Stop and Frisk, and in fact, they're highlighting it by redacting it. When this is, overtly in society, objectively speaking, Stop and Frisk is on trial. And even their attempts in the courtroom to kind of repeat this and repeat this line to the jury have been doing actually a whole lot more by the way of highlighting it than it has been in terms of censoring it. So that's kind of in one way that it's been brought into the courtroom, but this is a series of actions that where people put the bodies on the line to make a political statement against this policy, and to say that political statement is in any way divorced from their intent is just it's madness. It's divorcing it. It's divorcing it entirely from the content of the protest, and this is, this is something that goes right to the, right to the heart of a moral imperative in our intent and what we were drawing from and what we were inspired to. Looking at the parallels between the system of the old kind of system of formal control under the old Jim Crow and now this system of control under the new Jim Crow, and looking at the old freedom fighters and the freedom rides of the 60s, and looking at what was needed and necessary to engage this into public discourse. So this is something that where Stop and Frisk is being put on trial, where Stop and Frisk was put on trial when we were at the 103rd Precinct, where Stop and Frisk is put on trial when we're being booked and processed, where Stop and Frisk is being put on trial when we're in the courtroom, and we're bringing many, many more people into the fight in order to put it on trial. It's objectively speaking, in society, it's on trial.
I've read a statement, I guess, from the DA or somebody who was saying that he didn't want to allow the questioning of or the presentation of a case built on assault on rights, the right to protest and so on. And he said that you can't really talk about these things in the courtroom because this will just confuse the jurors. And I'm thinking about, the impact of Stop and Frisk across the city of New York and how many people have actually been impacted by this. And one of the things when he was saying was it will confuse the jurors. I mean, one, it's just so damn arrogant. But then the other thing is when they actually were questioning the jurors, a whole lot of the jurors themselves had very strong feelings about Stop and Frisk and had been impacted by that themselves, some of them actually having been stopped and frisked themselves. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you had, I mean, this is one of the things that, that kind of led to a flowering in jury selection that you wouldn't see on a typical jury selection. Like the voir dire questions had to do with how do you feel about protests? How do you feel about the New York City's police department stop and frisk policy? You know, this is a controversial policy. Do you have any feelings on that policy? If you do have strong feelings in either direction on it, are you able to keep them to yourself? We heard people speak to having been stopped, you know, having been stopped themselves or having, you know, and speak to their relationships with the police. One prospective juror, you know, spoke on her son being, her son working for Urban Outfitters and calling in a burglary at 3 a.m. or calling in a break-in at 3 a.m., the police arriving and then treating him like he was the criminal. And just saying how that just totally challenged. This is a woman who who's very close relative is a police officer and they're very close. But that was an instance that completely changed her perspective of the police and what they were out there doing. And you heard people speak to, first you had, you know, the judge kind of lay out, now this is not about stop and frisk the issue. Stop and frisk the issue is not on trial here, let me remind you. But instead, this is about the actions of what these people did. And then as the defense comes out and as people are, you know, and these prospective jurors during jury selection were wondering, what had these people done? What and why were they there? The issue became more and more conflated so that through the course of it, kind of at the end, one juror raises their hand and says, now I'm confused because you actually can't, you know, separate what they were doing and why they were there and the police's reaction to that. And, you know, and saying, we need to know all of that. This is a jury that obviously didn't make it, but you see how this is, you know, how consciously, you know, this is emerging in the courtroom and being brought out into the courtroom. Mm-hmm. We'll start to see a lot more, again, in the testimony that we're offering, the testimony from the defendants. Yeah, I mean, but you have seen overt kind of attempts from the judge himself to really clamp down on this is not about stop and frisk is not on trial here. And yet you have, during jury selection, people speaking to their feelings about stop and frisk being weighed by either side as to, you know, what, you know, you're seeing jury selection being affected by that. You're seeing, prosecution and opening arguments being shaped by that. You're seeing the testimony of the police officers. And what they're willing to admit and not to admit that they recall around stop and frisk, why they were there that day, or just why there was so heavy of a police presence there, how much advance warning that they had. You know, you're seeing all of this mm-hmm. relate to stop and frisk.
All right, one more time. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Jamel Mims. Now, Jamel is part of the Stop and Frisk movement, and he's one of four defendants who are currently on trial, each facing 2 years in prison up in Queens, New York. And in fact, they're on trial for a demonstration they took part in at the 103rd Precinct, which is the precinct notorious for its heinous murder of a young black man, Sean Bell, as he was out celebrating the night before his wedding. Let me ask you this, Jamel, and it's real quick because we only have about a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes left to do this. But give people a very broad sense, a very compacted response to this. Just the numbers, the size, the sheer size, the quantity of stop and frisk that's happening on a yearly basis. And then talk about the stakes in all this. And we really have about 2 minutes, okay?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm glad you really asked this question. And it's actually a great point to leave people with. You're looking at a policy that affects 19, if we're just talking about New York City alone, and we know this happens all over. I grew up in D.C., and they don't call it stop and frisk in D.C., but it happened to me all the time. And this is a policy that in New York City alone affects 1,900 people per day. You know, 94% of the people that they stop are not doing anything wrong, as in they're not even, issued a summons. And the remaining 6%, you know, make up a combination of just like small, very small violations of small charges that actually have been trumped up. And so you're looking at 1,900 times a day, 685,000 times per year. You take that and you multiply by every black and Latino youth in New York City. You know, they've in fact stopped, made more stops than there are actually black youth in New York City. The ratio is higher than 1-to-1. What you're looking at, and when you see that as a pipeline program to a whole system that has 2.4 million people behind bars, 8 million people under some kind of community supervision that keeps them in torturous conditions and then denies their rights and their fundamental and basic rights. And once they get out, you're looking at a picture of genocide. You're looking at a system of mass incarceration that is a system of racialized control that is, yes, analogous and has some continuity with the old Jim Crow, but has very distinct and insidious differences. And in fact, is like an entire order worse. What we're dealing with is the counterinsurgency before the insurgency. You know, you have no way for this for the rulers of this system to continue to exploit that population. And so as an answer, they offer them terrible schools, mass incarceration.
All right, Jamel, we're going to have to wrap it up.
With that. Are,
go ahead, yeah. Real quick. We have ten seconds.
Real quick. So what the stakes are is, where do you want to fall in the line of history? Where do you, you know, where do people want to fall when they look at history and when they see this, when they see situate this in a historical circumstance, where do you want to fall? Do you want to fall on the side of you know, do you want to fall on the side of just going on and letting it happen, or do you want to fall on the side of standing up and resisting the system of mass incarceration and the new Jim Crow?
All right, Jamel, we're going to have to stop there, and because we are really up against our time, but we'll have you back again to find out what happens in all this. So thank you very much, man. All right, take care now.
All right, thanks again.
Sure. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jamel Mims, who's one of the people standing on trial in New York City, in Queens, New York City, for daring to stand up and fight against stop and frisk, saying stop and frisk. And you know what? When he was talking about what's at stake for all of us, is can we turn our backs on all of these people, on these almost 750,000 people a year who are being stopped and frisked and their humanity being completely assaulted? Do you want to turn your back on that? We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to a new audio clip from Bob Avakian. It's about, let's be real here, as bad as Bush was, in many ways, Obama is worse. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That's Van Morrison with Educating Archie. All right, you're a slave to the capitalist system. Never forget that. All right, for all of you who have been out there wringing your hands or sometimes closing your eyes or closing your ears or being like, you know, these people who've told me, I don't want to hear all the bad stuff. I don't want to hear all the bad stuff. We don't have any choice but to vote for Obama. This is a very important public service announcement, okay? And this is a new audio clip from Bob Avakian. I'm not going to say a whole lot more about it except the title again, Let's Be Real Here. As bad as Bush was, in many ways, Obama is worse. So let's listen to what Avakian has to say.
And let's be real here. Let's not dance around the issue. Let's get right to it. As bad as Bush was, in many ways, Obama is even worse. And what's happening under Obama is worse. Things that people would never have put up under Bush, they put up with now, silently, and in paralysis under Obama. And I don't want to pick on him in particular, but I can't help thinking of Michael Eric Dyson. Now, he wrote this book a while ago, taking on the whole Bill Cosby thing of blaming the masses of black people and youth for their conditions, ridiculing the kind of names that women come up to name their baby. I always thought those names were tremendously creative, by the way. But he's denouncing them for those names and for the, you know, the old tired thing about pull up your pants and be respectful, as if that's why they're in the conditions they're in. So here we have the situation where Obama comes into office, and the first thing he does is go do his Bill Cosby act at a black church, preach on Father's Day, if I'm not mistaken, preaching all this stuff about, you know, well, all the men who are in prison. Well, who put them in prison? Who created the conditions where they had very few options besides the ones that would land them dead or in prison? Talking about, once again, get right, get serious, pull up your pants. All this kind of stuff. Obama doing his Bill Cosby act. And one of the things that we should understand is that with all this talk around the time Obama was first running for president about how this was going to uplift the people and provide a model for the youth and inspire them to greater things. The truth is, Obama and his presidency have done tremendous harm to the masses of black people. Why and how? Because the conditions have not improved for the masses. They're still being sent to prison. They're still being stopped and frisked. They're still being shot down in the street. They still can't get any work. Women are still being evicted from the housing project. Nobody talks about that. It's right to talk about and fight against people being in the middle class being evicted from their homes, but what about all the women being evicted out of the housing projects? You won't find that on anybody's lips, hardly. All the conditions are the same or worse, but what happens? Well, now you have a black president, so you have no excuse. And this was run out straight up by some of these right-wing politicians the night Obama was elected. I watched one of them, Bill Bennett, on TV. Now there's no more excuses. If you and three of your friends are hanging out on the street corner in L.A., and you happen to be in violation of some judge's injunction, which should be totally unconstitutional, which declares that four of you hanging out together constitutes a gang, and so they can come arrest you, and you start down the pipeline to prison, that's your fault, because there's a black president and you got no excuses. If you're trying to keep your son, if you look out the window and see the police moving toward your son and you run out the door to try to save your son and you're too late and they shoot him down, that's your fault, because there's a black president and you have no excuses. If you have no job and you're hanging out on the corner and you get caught up in some mess with some gang from another neighborhood and you shoot somebody, that's your fault. You had other options. You can't say there's any barrier to you because there's a black president. This is a game they're running with Obama, and it's not even a game. It's very serious, and Obama is part of it. And you can't say he's not, because that's why he went and made that speech. No excuses. So the oppression and injustice goes on and gets worse, but now insult is added to the injury, and injury is added to injury because it's your fault. Clear as day, because there's a black president, nothing stands in your way. You can be whatever you want to be. And this is doing tremendous harm. It's not neutral, and it's definitely not an inspiration to lift people up. Now, I could go on and on talking about the crimes of the system. The other time I threw out the question, name a continent where these imperialists have not committed terrible atrocities against humanity. Antarctica? Not even there, if you take into account what they're doing to the environment. And I could go on and on with Obama, with his maintaining torture. Closing Guantanamo? That was an election promise from Obama. Still open, last I knew. Meanwhile, he's persecuting Bradley Manning and Julian Assange for revealing cables and other things that brought to light war crimes committed by the U.S. in Iraq and other places. Obama meets every week with his advisors to draw up lists of people that he's going to order be assassinated from the air through drones and in other ways, without any due process, just on the say-so of the president. And yes, I'm going to come back to Michael Eric Dyson. We're not going to let him get away here. Obama firing drones. Many continents now, not just one or two countries. Killing hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians. Backing Israel to the hilt in all of its crimes. Maintaining people in worse than jail-like conditions in the Gaza Strip and occupied territories. And in all this, you see, Obama is acting on the basic logic of the system of which he is the chief executive and commander-in-chief. The basic logic and the basic assumption that flows from it, that U.S. imperialism has the right to dominate the world, that it has the right to commit as much mayhem and slaughter as it deems necessary to impose and maintain its empire, and it has the right to kill anybody who gets in the way. And now Obama's also got a new law that can hold people in indefinite detention for the rest of your life without even a trial, without any due process, just as he can kill people on his say-so without, you know, we have a great country. It's the rule of law, not the rule of a person. Well, where's the rule of law in that? Even that facade and that charade is gone. Now, just think about this. You can tell a lot about people by the jokes that they tell and the jokes they want to tell. People say, oh, it's just a joke. Don't be offended. But jokes have content. You tell a racist joke, it's not fucking funny. There was a comedian a little while ago who was telling a joke about rape. And a woman in the audience very righteously said, rape is never funny. And he said, wouldn't it be funny if a bunch of guys raped you now? Ha ha. No. It's not fucking funny. But what people think is funny and not funny tells you a lot about them. In 2010, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Obama got up and gave these comments. This is supposed to be where they kind of joke around and show they're real human beings with a lighter side while they're killing people all over the world. And here's a joke Obama told, among others. He said, I see the Jonas Brothers are here, some musicians. I see the Jonas Brothers are here. My daughters are big fans, but don't get any ideas, because I got two words for you. Predator drone. You'll never see it coming. Now, this is a joke Obama wanted to tell, because this is how he wanted to portray himself. This is the kind of politician and political leader I am. Think about this joke. First of all, there's the obvious thing about you're making a joke out of killing people from the air with missiles that are fired from these drones that fly over foreign countries. But along with that, look at the view of the relation between men and women that are wrapped up in this joke. These are the old views that the daughters are the property of the father. And the father enters into some sort of negotiation with a suitor before the father will give approval to allow the daughter to marry someone. Not the idea of love between two people and the two people themselves deciding, but the father, the patriarch, is exercising control over his property, his daughters. It's like some old backcountry fool pulls out his shotgun. He ain't gonna have nothing to do with my daughter. Except Obama's not a backcountry fool. Obama's the president of the United States. He's the leader of the free world. He doesn't do it with a Tech 9 or a shotgun. He does it with predator drones. Now think about what it means that this man wants to tell this as a joke and wants people to think about him this way. It's a reflection of the putrid, dying, but still vicious nature of this system. Michael Eric Dyson, we got to get back to him. I saw him on a program. He was rationalizing all these things, excusing, trying to justify. Yes, it's bad that we went and bombed Libya. But when people struggle for democracy in a country like that, don't we have an obligation to help them? Now, you see, one hand, he giveth with one hand and taketh away with the other. Either it was a bad thing to bomb or it was a good thing. Don't try to say one and then the other. But there's a more basic point. Don't we have an obligation to help them? And to this, my answer is, what do you mean we, white man? You remember that joke from back in the 60s about the Lone Ranger? The Lone Ranger was a former Texas Ranger, vicious murderers of Native Americans in Mexico and Mexicans in Texas. And he had a sidekick, Tonto, the Indian. And there's a joke that came up when people started looking at the world differently in the 60s. The joke was that the Lone Ranger and Tonto were surrounded by Indians. And their position was getting more and more difficult. Like they said in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Your situation is helpless. And so at a certain point, when it really looked bad, a Lone Ranger turned to Tonto and said, well, it looks like we're really in trouble here, Tonto. And Tonto said back, what do you mean we, white man? Now, what has happened to Michael Eric Dyson that he's talking about we have to do this on behalf of this system just because it's being presided over by an African-American? And he went on trying to justify, yes, torture's bad, but it's complicated and so on. Now, I thought back to this book that Michael Eric Dyson wrote, taking on Bill Cosby in a pretty good way. And the title of the book was a good one. It said, "Is Bill Cosby Right, or Has the Black Middle Class Lost Its Mind?" And I couldn't help think about this as I listened to Michael Eric Dyson. And again, I'm not just trying to pick on him, and I hope he comes around. But I couldn't help thinking that maybe what should be said is Obama a friend of the oppressed, or has Michael Eric Dyson lost his mind? But I know there are people who recognize and who are affected by the fact that there are a bunch of lunatic, demented racists and Nazi types in this country who hate Obama and can't stand the fact that he's president. This is true. This is undeniable. But this really, if you think about it, is a condemnation of this whole system. Because these are not just a few fringe elements. These include people high up in the Republican Party, part of the overall power structure and ruling class of this country. And this shows you the whole system for what it is. Because every part of the power structure, every part of the ruling class of this country believes that those Republicans are legitimate and qualified to govern in society. If you go to Obama and you say, "We know you're running against the Republicans, you want people to vote for you instead of Romney, but do you think the Republicans are unqualified to govern and illegitimate?" He would say, "No, of course not. It's the great American system. We have two parties. That's why I'm always trying to reach across the aisle." And this tells you something not only about Obama, but about the whole system. It tells you if these people are legitimate and qualified to govern in this whole system is illegitimate. There's a double-sided sword to this demented, racist hatred for Obama, because they get two things out of it. One side, the ones who are into this, rile up their base of people who think like that and get them going in that way. And the other side, the Democrats, come along and take advantage of it and say, "See, you may not like Obama. You may be disappointed. He didn't do the things he promised he would do. He didn't turn out to be what you want him to be. But you can't let those people run things, can you?" And this is the way they get you. As long as we are confined within and can't, even our imagination can't escape the limits and terms of this system, we're always going to be bounced back and forth and buffeted around in this kind of way, and that we're always going to get played in a much more serious game than three-card Monty. So we have to look at the conflicts and contradictions in this society and in this system as part of the material out of which we build a movement for revolution, which can get to the point where it can fight and have a real fighting chance of getting rid of this system, not playing within it and keeping it going and giving our endorsement to its crimes, which is what we do every time we vote for one of these people. I mean, think about the Clintons. You know, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, all these crimes of Obama, bombing Libya and everything else that I've talked about are her crimes too. But go back a little bit when Bill Clinton was president. After the first war against Iraq in 1991, then Clinton came in. Hillary Clinton was not just his wife. She was, in her own right, a major player in this Clinton administration. They imposed sanctions on Iraq that crippled the sanitation facilities, the water treatment facilities, the medical facilities, in such a way, and they enforced it with no-fly zones and bombs and airplanes, in such a way that during the 1990s, over 1 million people in Iraq, that's like one out of every 30 people, died as a result of these sanctions, including over 500,000 children. You take your child to the hospital crying in pain, and they say, "We want to help you, but we can't because we don't have the sanitary facilities or the medicine or the technology to treat this because of the sanctions." And the Secretary of State at that time under Clinton was Madeleine Albright, and she went on TV and someone directly asked her, "Look, all these people, including children, are dying as a result of these sanctions just to try to keep pressure on Saddam Hussein. Do you think it's worth it?" And she said, "Well, it's complicated and it's difficult, but yes, we think it's worth it." These are the kind of people we're being asked to endorse and the kind of monstrous crimes we're being asked to endorse by voting for one politician or the other in this system. And plus, it just reinforces the idea that you can't have any basic change. Because as long as people keep voting for these things, and including some people vote for really bad things, then it just reinforces the idea that we could never have a big change. The terms are the wrong terms. The limits are too narrow. You can't break through and win people away from where they are towards something much better if you are trying to do it within the terms of this system and on the basis of its elections.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, a new audio clip from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And again, the title of that is Let's Be Real Here. As bad as Bush was, in many ways, Obama is worse. And if you want to download that for yourself or listen to it again, go to revcom.us. Again, that's revcom, R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M.us, revcom.us. And I'll tell you, this is something people got to really take seriously, really think about. Come on, folks. Let's remember that scene in School Days, that Spike Lee film School Days, where in the end, the cat was out there and he was ringing the bell as hard as he could on the campus and yelling, wake up, wake up. Well, it's time that all of us actually did a check and make sure we're awake and did everything we can to wake up other people. Because you know what? Silence in the face of all this that's going on is actually complicity with what's going on. And we cannot afford that. And I know people do not want to be complicit with such monstrous crimes that are being laid out on the world. So think about it. Open your eyes and get away from that very peculiar thing that the liberals in this country have going on. And that is their peculiar brand of the Oedipus complex, where what they do is they don't want to be sleeping with their mom. Instead, what they're doing is willfully blinding themselves. And we cannot afford that. So check out what Avakian is saying and check out other things and check out the truth. And then get behind actually what you think you need to be doing in relation to that. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and my production assistant, Henry Carson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. Again, if you want to write to me, you can, and believe me, I read every email I get, and I try to answer as many of them as I can. But if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. So we're going to go out now with a piece from Jimmy Cliff. I'm really in love with this album. The piece is One More. Check it out.